Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's December 16th, 2011, and you're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Mindbender Long. I am on the cruise ship right now, Chris. But because it's 60 cents a minute for internet, I'm not actually recording the show with you. So it's like I'm talking to you from the future. But I recorded it in the past. It's a conundrum.
Should I call you Michael J. Fox? Wow.
So yeah, a very special episode of the Ante Up here. That will challenge your mind a little bit.
I'm really hoping that nothing breaks news-wise while you're gone and we're playing this show. It's like,
well, see, that's what's great, because I'm in the future and I'm coming back to talk to you about the show, so don't worry, nothing's going to happen.
Okay, so you're going to have the whole Online Poker Gets Approved covered if it happens for me.
Absolutely, absolutely. Already taken care of it.
All right, thank you. Appreciate that.
I'm not going to tell you everything that happened because, you know, obviously I need to profit from it handsomely, but... But I will share a little words of wisdom here later on in the show.
Yeah, who won the World Series for the next 5 years?
Hey, you got to wait for the Ante Up News Desk.
Okay.
But next week's show, obviously, will be our cruise recap. Get everybody whipped into a frenzy so they want to join us on our future cruises. But for now, we got some good stuff to talk about here, I think.
Yeah, I like these types of shows where we're always throwing stuff out there and... And it's funny because last week's show, I alluded to the fact that I had talked to the tournament director at Foxwoods, Jeffrey Toth, and it's funny, he brought up something that we were going to talk about on this show anyway, so it's kind of interesting that it happened that way. I couldn't believe it. It was like he was psychic, like you are being, like you're being right now.
Crazy. We're going to be able to sort of show into something that we can sell to A&E.
That'd be really cool.
All right. Well, one of our readers that sent us this question last week, and he alleges he's upset at the three tournaments.
All right. Wait. Say it again, because I think we lost you. He alleges that what?
He's upset about re-entry tournaments.
Oh, okay.
There's this new trend he's noticing in the rooms he plays in. No one's doing rebuy tournaments anymore. They're all re-entry tournaments. And he alleges that the re-entry is nothing more than greed on the part of poker rooms, since an entry fee is charged on the re-entries but not on the rebuys.
Hmm.
And I think it's a good question, and I've gone back and forth with him on my views of it. But I think it's good to talk about, because I think he's right. I think we are seeing, at least anecdotally it seems to me, more re-entry tournaments now than we are rebuy tournaments.
Okay. Now, I am going to have to side on the poker room managers, because
this is going to be a bad segment, because I'm going to show some love to our managers as well.
Yeah, here's
probably
the deal.
We have a little fisticuffs here, but
hey, you don't have to re-enter if you don't want to. First of all, second of all, a rebuy and a re-entry are completely different situations. Re-entries, if I'm reading them correctly, re-entries usually if they're across 2 days, you know, you're entering at the same time as everyone else, the same stacks. Rebuys, you're buying in right there, and there's a lot larger chip stacks out there and a lot more chips in play when you're starting over again. And, you know, it's funny because they'd like to, sure, I mean, poker room managers would like to do it because they will make more money, but you don't have to re-enter. That's the thing. You don't have to do it. It's just an option if you want to do it. There are re-entry tournaments where you re-enter the same day, but...
Yeah.
You know, if those
are at the same table too.
Yeah, so, the same table.
That's a little different, but
those are if you want to do that and you don't want it to be a rebuy tournament, well then that's your prerogative to play in it. And I think as a player, that's probably a foolish decision. If you're going to re-enter play a tournament that's a re-entry tournament and not play on day 1B, then you know, if that's a possibility, then I wouldn't do it because I'd rather just play in a rebuy where there are no fees charged to me. So I wouldn't play a re-entry unless it was the second day or another day. And I don't play rebuys anyway, but I can see the reason why you'd want to have a re-entry, you know, because you're looking at the prize pool and you're thinking, oh my God, I want another crack at that. So you come back the next day and play in it. I just don't see how it's greed. You don't have to play in it if you don't want to. So how are they being greedy?
All right. Well, you know, I love to play the devil's advocate, so I'll defend our reader a little bit here, even though I don't agree completely. I mean, I think the point is, you know, hey, you can get the prize pool built up. You know, if you want to allow people to continue to play after they've been knocked out, you can do it with a rebuy. In the rebuy, there's no entry fee charged on it. The re-entry now, you know, let's say it's $100 to get in the tournament. In a rebuy tournament, when you pay $100, that $100, all that $100 goes to the prize pool. When you re-enter, it's probably $85 goes to the prize pool, $15 goes to the house. So it's not good from a prize pool standpoint for a player. But what I'll say is that you're right. They're different events. And I think the re-entry, I guess what really got me was the line greed. I hate when people use greed.
Yeah.
Because I think it's an oversimplification of what's going on here. Are there rooms out there that are doing this purely on greed? Sure, probably. I'm not going to say they're not. Obviously, it does make financially to do it this way. But there are reasons why they do it, and they need to do it. So here's a couple things I told them about why I think it's important not to be so sharp in your criticism on this, but to explain to managers, if they have the choice between the two, why the players would rather be a rebuy. But, you know, one of the things I explained to them is that I've talked to some managers that say, you know, hey, I've always wanted to do rebuy tournaments, but we just haven't been able to do it because you need to – it takes so much administrative hassle. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to have chips, and you got the dealers either handling the money at the table in the middle of the tournament, or you got floors running over and doing rebuys. That's expensive.
Yep.
So they're just like, you know, we can't do it. But now a re-entry allows them to offer that now, because now you're getting up from the table, you're walking into the cage where the money is and where people normally register, and it takes away all that administrative headache. Now, obviously, you know, you're paying a separate entry fee, but it gives them the option of doing something that they aren't now, and I think that's good for players. Obviously, if it's a room that can handle it both ways, then that's a different story. But a lot of rooms, I think, are excited now that they can offer a rebuy-like tournament to their players that they couldn't before. And then I think the other thing, too, is the prize pool. I mean, obviously, in a rebuy, people go into with a mindset, I think, of rebuying a lot.
Yeah.
You know, you hear these pros. I mean, Daniel Negreanu is famous for it. You know, hey, I just want to keep rebuying and get money on the table. That's a different strategy. Mm-hmm. Re-entry takes that away. And you can still get in, so you have some protection, but in most rooms, you're not going to be sitting back down at the same seat at the same table. You don't know where you're going to go. It's a lottery. So a lot of that strategy changes. So it's a different type of tournament. And then think about this, too. I mean, when you're in a rebuy tournament, you can't, when you get felted, right, you can't say, you know what, I'm going to get up and walk around the track for a while. I'll come back in half an hour and decide whether I want to get back in. No, in a rebuy tournament, you got to decide right then before the next hand. Are you back in or not?
Yep.
When you're out, you're gone. Re-entry allows you to get up, think about it. All right, I'll go play some cash and make some money back, and I get a cash, I can still get in the tournament. So I think a re-entry tournament actually builds the prize pool, has the potential of building the prize pool bigger than a rebuy tournament. And that is good for players, I think.
And sometimes, too, the rebuys are less than the buy-in. Like, you
sometimes,
know, yeah, the buy-in's like a $200 buy-in, but the rebuy is $100, you know, or something. The rebuys aren't always the same, too. So there's always that as well. I have to admit that I had a little tunnel vision on this, thinking that the re-entry was always on another day, whereas there are tournaments that have re-entries the same day. If it's a different day, then there's no argument here for me, you know?
Yeah.
But if they have re-entries,
if it's the same day, because I think that's what's becoming more common now, a same-day re-entry.
Yeah.
What, how's that changed that for you?
Well, I do feel like the only reason to do a re-entry then is, like you said, as far as a player, is I want to give it some thought. I want to take a look at how the field's rounding out. And, you know, I want to know, is it worth me paying the extra juice to get in when I could have just played a rebuy tournament and not pay the juice? So I think that it gives you a little flexibility as to whether or not you want to play again. I don't know if that changes our writer, the person who wrote in, our listener, if that changes their thought about it. If it's two different days and that's what he's talking about, then I really have no qualms. I don't agree with the greed aspect. I think the poker room managers are looking to make money. They're not looking to just give money away because they need to run a business and be successful and keep their jobs. But I also think that they're trying to give you as many varieties as possible when it comes to your playing and what you can do in the tournament. And so, like you said, you might want to get up and try to cash games for a little while. You might play in the cash games for a little while and make enough for an entry and say, you know, I want to keep playing that tournament. I felt like I was good, but I didn't have enough money on me. Now I've won enough at the cash games. Or whatever the scenario is, it gives you options. So I really don't think it's greed. I just don't. I think that, sure, they like to make money, and if they're offering that variety or they're offering that sort of way to do something, then you know what comes with that. You know you're paying the fee if you want to do it. Rebuys are not re-entry tournaments. They're different tournaments. So you have to think of that re-entry as another person, not as just more money in the prize pool with the same person in the tournament. It's different. Yeah. So I don't know. But anyway, one of the things that it's not exactly what he was asking about, but Jeff Toth had said they don't have re-entry tournaments at Foxwoods because of the software. Their software won't allow them to do it. And they've tried workarounds, and every workaround they try to do just ends up creating more of a problem and making it less fluid, and it doesn't work out. And it will take a massive rewrite of their software for them to have to be able to do re-entries by the way they do it and the system they use, and they have to use the system they're using. So we sat there in his office for like 20 minutes trying to come up with ways to do it, and there was always something that was roadblocking it, whether it was, you know, the form itself or creating a whole different tournament, but you still have to re-enter the person into it. You know, so there was all these ways that it wouldn't work for his current software. So that could be some of the things, too, that maybe people don't have rebuy software, but they do have re-entry software. Or they figured out, you know what I mean? I don't know what the reason is. So there's all kinds of things that could be lending themselves.
Now, he was saying that about re-entry?
Yeah, they can't do re-entries.
All right, I guess I'm curious as to, I mean, if he got into why, because I would think, you know, the tournaments that I've done the re-entry, you know, you get felted, you stand up, hey, good game, everyone, thanks, and you walk to the cage, and you just re-enter.
Yeah, no, it's the
software.
It just
seems like it'd be, well, I know, but I don't understand why the software would be a problem on that.
Because you're already in the tournament, and your name and number and your whatever it is already listed in the tournament, so by doing it again, you still have to take out the fee. And then you're adding another person in, and it's yourself again. So you're not. Believe me, he knows everything. So.
Oh no, I'm not saying he's wrong. I was curious.
I guess that makes sense
if the software was built to prevent the same person from entering a tournament.
Right.
Twice.
Exactly. So once you launch it, once the software is launched and the buy-in period or whatever is, once it's launched, he can't go back into it and add things to it.
Yeah,
it's done, or you know, whatever the software was. So that's why they don't have re-entry tournaments.
Interesting.
Rebuys, you don't need to worry about the player field because the field's still set.
Right.
It makes no difference. But he said he'd like to have re-entries, but they just don't fit into their software, and it would require a massive overhaul to do it. So, but again, that's just one other thing. Lending, if it works that way, then maybe for other places they can't do rebuys, but they can do re-entries or whatever. I don't know. So there are probably reasons for doing it, and I don't think greed is one of them.
All right, well, hey, good debate to have, and I think it's going to continue to have, because I think, as we said, we see the re-entry model taking the place of the rebuys in a lot of places. But, you know, the final note, I told Peter, you know, hey, you're more than in your right to complain about this and tell poker managers that you prefer rebuy, but use that language. I prefer rebuys, and here's why.
Yeah.
I think if you go into it saying you guys are being greedy, you're not going to get anywhere. And not just because you're not going to get anywhere, but I honestly don't think that that's the case in most of these situations. I think it's actually rooms trying to be nice to the players and offering them something that they can't now. So,
yeah.
But certainly, you know, raise your concerns, and you know, rooms that could do both, maybe you'll convince them to go back to the rebuy.
Yeah, and like I said, I have that tunnel vision toward re-entries always being on another day, and I like that a lot more. I mean, I would love to know that if I played in a horse tournament and got knocked out because of a suck out or something, and if I had the money to buy in again the next day, I would like to come back and try it again with everyone else who has.
But you wouldn't
want to
do it that day.
Well, no, I don't think I would, because I'm not. I don't like to be starting over at a disadvantage
You know, I mean, at level six, somebody has 25,000 chips at my table, or
well, it would be level six.
Whatever. Well, re-entries, you can re-enter at level six. I think you can go as far as six levels to re-enter.
Well, some tournaments. Most places now, it's like within the first hour or the first three rounds.
But that's rebuys, not re-enters. Right? Rebuys are like that.
But no, re-entry, whatever the late registration is. So, I mean, it's the same thing as if you show up to the poker room late and you want to get in. Whatever that cutoff is usually when the reentry cutoff is.
Oh, okay. I thought
so.
It was,
you can't reenter all the way. You can't get knocked out heads up at the final table.
No. I thought it was level six, though. I thought it was level six.
It depends. I mean, it depends on the room. But but I think most of them I've played it, and reentry is usually the first three levels of the first hour or something like that.
Right.
So,
and same thing,
it doesn't change too much to you, but I mean, yeah.
I just don't like sitting at a table with somebody who has a huge stack with me when I'm starting all over. So that's why I don't do rebuys either.
Makes a difference. All right, well, you know, we're getting a lot of questions from our readers and clients, and one of our clients sent me an email this week, just curiously asking, who are the top five most famous poker players now? And he added that he doesn't think it's that clear. So I thought about it for the minute, and I think he's right. I think it's not. You would think, oh, yeah, that's easy. I can rip off five names that I think are right. And I thought about it for a little bit, and I was conflicted. So, and I know you started to think about it as well too. And I decided, you know what? Let's make this a topic of a show. We had so much fun with the poker players on money thing.
Yeah.
And so let's give it a couple weeks here and let our listeners chime in. So email us to podcast@antiupmagazine.com or post in our forum at antiupmagazine.com/forum. Who you think the top five most famous poker players are now? And we'll devote a show to this in the new year, here in the next couple weeks, and have a little bit of discussion on what you think famous means too, because that was what was tripping me up a little.
Me too. Because you know, are they the top five famous people in the poker world, or are they in the world?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you know, if I go to the guy next door in my neighborhood, he doesn't play poker, he doesn't know who Doyle Brunson is,
right?
You know what I mean? But he might know who Emerald Slim is, and he might know who Johnny Moss is, or you know, or something. So it is. It's very interesting. So give some thought to that too. I would think that we would probably think it's the poker world, and not the general world. Because
we'll save that discussion for the show.
Yeah, but let's see what everybody sends in to us. Hey, you know, we have a hotline, but because you're on the ship, we couldn't predict.
$4.95 a minute.
The people would call in. Costs a lot of money to have you answer the phone and hear it. So. Well, yeah, we have no hotline this week, but we do want to remind you it's 813-448-1120. And if you call that number and we're somehow around and not cheap to try to check it and listen to it, we can give you something really cool, like a T-shirt from PMS Pokerwear, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the AntiUp store at antiupstore.com.
All right, but our mailbag is working, and an old friend, Bernice Q.
Bernice Q.
Wrote it. Actually, she's going by Amy Mech now because she thinks it's kind of ridiculous to use her online name when she can't play online anymore. But
she yelled at me.
But she'll always be Bernice Q to us. So.
She yelled at me.
Yeah, well, you had it coming.
I deserved it.
All right, well, she you know, she lives in New York City, so she plays a lot of home games. And I like this one because she wrote in to tell us, we sometimes play with a rule that says you cannot look at your hole cards after the flop is dealt. Pretty cool. I mean, really, that's a good skill to have anyhow, because you're giving away some information when you go back and peek anyhow. But they mandate it in their home games. He says, if you do look, you have to pay every player $1.
Jeez.
So if you look and then you complain about the bad beat story after that, you're up to $2 now if Chris is in the game. All right, so if you look after the flop, you got to pay every player $1. So it's just, she says it happened that someone was involved with a hand, looked at his whole cards post-flop, bad boy, got caught, and then went all in. So he owed the table, all seven players, $1 each. But the question came up, should he pay it out of his stack, which he had just pushed all in, meaning the person who called his all-in will not be able to win those $7, or... does he pay it after the hand is over, which means if he lost the all-in, he'd have to take another $7 out of his pocket and pay the table after being felted. She says, I feel like the infraction happened before he pushed all-in, so the money should be taken out of his stack before the push all-in. But others thought that the player who called all-in should have the right to win that money since it was in the all-in player stack when the hand began. from which someone might calculate implied odds. So I know there's no set rule on this. It's a ridiculous rule that someone made up, but she's just merely curious what side we come down on if we were sitting in a bar talking about this.
I come down on the side of remove the rule. Then you don't have to worry about this.
I don't think anybody's worried about it. It's just a curious question.
Okay, well, my thing is...
It's like when Hong Kong Fooey beat the underdog in a fight. You know, obviously it's never going to happen, but it doesn't mean you can't have fun talking about it.
Well, here's the deal. Now, when we had our home game and the Kentucky Derby was going on, you guys were like, let's put 50 cents in every time you win a pot, you know, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's 50 cents that we're not able to win if we're not contributing to this pot to play in this stupid gambling thing you guys are doing. And that's money coming off the table. And if you guys make, like, you know, how much did that end up being? How much did that end up being? Was that like
about $4,000?
Yeah. So $4,000 came off our table. We didn't get a chance to win it. So I thought that was similar to this.
Play our reindeer games.
Right. But what we ended up doing was making you guys match it or pay it or I don't know what it was, but it was weird. So this is kind of weird to me, but I think that if they all agree to it, then when the infraction happens, that's when it gets paid. So that before he could say all in, he has to pay the dollar to everybody. That's how I feel, because if
I'm sure it happened really quickly, but I agree. I mean, it's at the point of infraction.
You've committed the infraction, the $7 comes out, and you all agree that the $7 comes out. So that way, if you decide to call this person's all in, you can't complain about it because you agreed that the infraction happened first. That needs to get paid before the all-in could have been done, even if he didn't say all-in when he looked at his cards. So, and then the person who calls, if they do call, then, you know, hey, if you're calculating odds and $7 means something to you, then you shouldn't agree to the whole peek at the whole cards, pay a dollar rule in the first place. So, I don't know. I feel like the infraction happened. It needs to be satisfied first.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, is I think we play table stakes, right?
Yeah, so the money's on the
table. So, I mean, when you go all in, you don't say, unless you're playing on TV, I'm all in plus another $7 in my pocket.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to force somebody to go in the... I mean, what happens if they go in the pocket and they bust?
Yeah.
And we got $7. Are you going to wash dishes at the home game? So I think it's table stakes. So I think I really don't think there's any way you could do it outside of that. But it is an interesting point about the calculating applied odds. Most interesting, the fact that people are capable of doing that, because I'm not. So I'm really impressed. But I don't think they thought about this when they whoever got drunk and said, hey, guess what? If you look at your cards, you have to pay a dollar. Yeah, that sounds great. Woohoo! I don't think they thought about what would happen on this situation, which is obviously why she's writing in. I mean, you know, if you're not all in, it doesn't matter. You're $7. That's off the table. That doesn't really matter at that point.
So we know that when people write in and ask us for advice, they use our advice like it's, you know, ironclad. So here's our ultimate ruling. Pass this down to your home game friends. If the person looks at his cards or her cards, they have to pay the dollar on the spot, and that is what their stack is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the deal. That we agree, and now you have to implement that rule into your home game, and we expect that when we play in your home game that to be enforced. So.
All right. Well, one more thing. I just got a solution to Bernice if this calculating implied odds. It doesn't. The all-in complicates this. It doesn't matter, right?
Right.
I mean, if it, let's say you both have $4,000 in front of you, and the bet's $26, and you're factoring your odds, and then someone looks at his card, the money still comes off at the table.
Right.
Doesn't matter that you're all in or not. I mean, it still messes up your odds.
Yeah.
So you're screwed either way. So it doesn't matter that it's all in.
Right, because you're playing table stakes and not going in his pocket for $7.
Problem solved.
Yeah, there you go.
See, we're problem solvers.
That's what we do.
All right, so folks, remember you can email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and if you do and we use it on the show, we'll be happy to send you something great, like a download of the Poker Hand Breakdown Pro, a hand history analysis program for single or mixed games from element26.net.
All right, another call to the floor. This comes from Nick, our good friend Nick. He says, in a home game tournament, it folds to him in a small blind he raises. The big blind isn't sitting in his seat, but a guy who had busted out earlier was sitting there and re-raises. I tell him, you can't do that. Where is the big blind? False big blind says, he went to the restroom and told me to play his hand. I and several others tell him that he can't do that and that he knows better. The big blind comes back, and the false big blind tells him he raised at 1,200. I tell him that it did not count and that the action was on him. Without looking at his cards, he bets 1,200.
Yes.
Frustrated with the whole thing, I shove all in, and without looking at his cards, he calls.
Awesome.
Were his cards dead because of A, he was not in the room when the action was on him, B, someone else started playing his cards, or C, by acting on the false big blind's invalid action, there were now two players playing his cards. Our normal rule is that if you are not in your seat, but you are getting back to it, we let you play. If you're nowhere to be seen, we fold you.
All right, this is a very easy answer. It's D, quit doing this crazy stuff in your home games, folks.
It's our wacky home game edition, not Annie Up.
Yeah, I mean, you go to the bathroom, you got it, now all of a sudden it's a tag team world intercontinental championship.
How did you recognize that the guy sat down that wasn't the guy who was there 5 seconds ago on your left? I don't understand that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it must have been, you know, contributing to the Kentucky Derby Fund or something. And a little confused. But no, jeez. Seriously, I mean, folks, you know, I love getting these home game questions, and we'd like to help you keep the peace in the home game tournament. But sometimes they're just borderline ridiculous here. This is a ridiculous situation. I'm totally with Nick here. I'd be totally upset with this. There are 17 shades of wrong here. So the whole hand should have just been done. Just take the big blind, or if you want to be nice, say, hey, we'll redeal and or hold or whatever, I don't know, until the big blind gets back. But you can't have people tag teaming in.
No way.
And acting and then getting in the debate about whether the cards are live or no.
Give me another no, just in case.
No. And I mean, I guess what's most galling to me in this is that normally what I would say in this situation, and I'm sure you would do too, is, you know, hey, folks, this is why you set up rules in your home game ahead of time.
Yeah.
And in this one, they have the rules set up. You're not in your seat, but you're getting back to it, we let you play. If you're nowhere to the scene, we fold you.
You can't make up your own rules.
Change by having your cat sit down and play your big blind for you. That's a change. This is a home game that I would be frustrated in. You know, if people say, hey, you know, we're changing the rules now on what we agreed. It's a little different when you encounter a situation in a home game that you've never encountered before and you have to figure out how to make it right at that point. And then you can, after you're done, talk about it more and come up with a rule that you all can agree in the future. But this is one where you already have a rule.
Yeah, you have a rule. Well, what gave this guy the gall to say, hey, buddy, come over here and sit down for me and play my hand while I'm gone? And then one, to not run it by the table and say, hey, is it okay if Joe comes over here and plays my hand while I'm gone? Because then he would have said, no, we have the rule in place. Go take a whiz and run back or you're not going to have a hand. You know, I mean.
You know, who gets up to go to the bathroom when they're in the big blind?
I know.
I mean, that's like that's almost as rude as reclining your seat on an airplane. You just don't do it.
Oh, my God. So
absolutely crazy. Well, you know, obviously, we're not going to waste Jody Russell's time with this because he's busy running our poker room here on the NAL Poker Cruise. And we're doing quite well, by the way, Chris.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
You have to live up to that now, buddy.
And there's really, I mean, I can only imagine Jody's gasket blowing. Sending him a question like this. But you know, hey, continue to send your call to the floors to us at podcast@aniamagazine.com. Legitimate ones will have Jody answer and clear it up. Non-legitimate ones we'll put on the show anyhow and have fun with them.
This next one comes from Dr. Frank, our good friend and sometimes columnist for a Healthy Bet column on the in the magazine. And I wondered, I kind of reacted to this, but he sort of called me after I reacted to it, and we started talking about it, too. It's about betting the nuts. Do you want to read it, or do you want me to read it?
I'll read it since you got time.
Okay.
Something to say about it. He says, I've never liked the, quote, must bet the nuts. And he spelled nuts with a Z, and I never liked that. That's what I don't really like.
The Z means it's cool.
Yeah, yeah. He says, all right, so I've never liked the must bet the nuts rule, even in tournament play. What if you don't realize you have the nuts? That could happen in Omaha with a complicated rap. Should you be penalized for being inexperienced? What if portraying an image of being a donk is part of your metagame? In cash games, I'm really against the rule. Imagine a multi-way pot where there's no pair on the board and no flush possibilities, but the board contains king, queen, jack, 10. Surely several players will have the nuts. Most everyone in the hand with an ace go all in. That helps to get more rake. I'm not a fan of this rule at all. At all, with my emphasis.
I agree. I told him that... It is one of those rules that will always and forever never satisfy everyone. And I guess the more offensive problem is the collusion, so you have to go with it that way. And if you're inexperienced, well, now guess what? You're experienced because you just got a penalty for not being experienced and knowing the rule. I mean, that's probably the only way really to look at this, because otherwise you're opening up to angle shooting and collusion galore. You know, if you don't have to bet the nuts and you're in a hand with your friend, you know, or if you're in a hand with a partner or whatever you want to call it. So although I agree with him, I understand why you want to see someone's hand, you want to see how they play it, you may not have meant to. You know, whatever it is, I totally understand. But at the same time, I think we have to protect. We protect a lot more than we hurt by having the rule in place.
That's true. That is true. Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is, and I totally agree. I mean, and we've seen, you know, folks have sent us, you know, videos of Darvin Moon doing this at the World Series and saying, you know, hey, I wanted to see his cars. A legitimate thing. Right. I can agree with that. And one of the problem here is if you take the rule out, then you open yourself up to the collusion.
Yeah.
So it's one of those rules that you have to have in, because if you don't have it in, it could be abused. And while it's in, it seems ridiculous in 99% of the times, but it's that one time that it's not ridiculous that you really need the rule. But a couple more things that I mentioned to Frank, too, and obviously not trying to pile onto him on the show, but I've always heard it was always in No Limit Hold'em. I haven't heard that it was in Omaha. I guess it depends. It's certainly not in Omaha high-low.
Right.
Unless there's a no-low on there. But and I don't think it's ever enforced in cash games that I've heard. It's a tournament rule, isn't it?
No, I don't know. Well, you know, I don't think it's ever happened to me, but I think in cash games, you know, I don't know.
I mean, there's no collusion in cash games. I mean, at that point, and you're right. I mean, at that point, forcing someone to bet, it does the house does have an incentive, if you want to be that cold about it, in forcing you to bet in a cash game in a tournament, that they've already got your entry fee. So they're not, the house isn't gaining anything there. I really think it's a TDA. It comes up in the TDAs, even though it's not in the rules, as we mentioned.
Right.
I don't think it, in the cash games, you could do whatever you want, I think. Maybe I'm wrong. But
no, I think that we talked about the rake and being a reason why, so I'm pretty sure that cash games, you have to bet the nuts. I don't know what the penalty is, though. That's the thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, when you sit out for a round, you know.
Well, you might get a warning or something, and then if you do it again, they might throw you out. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. But I'm pretty sure you have to have it in cash games, too, because there is colluding in cash games. Of course there is. There's partners and guys raising to get you out.
Yeah, but cash game. I mean, if your head's up at the end with your buddy in a cash game and one of you doesn't raise, no one benefits from that.
Well, but I guess you're missing the point there. That's the third person involved that they get out, and then he doesn't bet the nuts at the end, and then when they just
but that's a different that's not betting the nuts. That's a different. That's a whole different ball of wax there. What we're talking about is just at the end, if you had the nuts and you're not betting it.
I'm talking about if you have a third person in the hand with you and your friend you're colluding with, and then you're not betting the nuts because you don't want. Like, in other words, if player A is your friend, player B isn't. Player A makes a bet because they're trying to get player B out. They get player B out, and player C just calls on the end, doesn't re-raise with the nuts. Then they say, why didn't you raise the nuts? And now it's your friend over there, and why wouldn't you raise your friend? Because you didn't, and you're in cash games.
Okay,
and
got player B out. That's not the... That has nothing to do with the nuts there.
Yeah,
that's,
he has the nuts. Player C has the nuts and doesn't raise.
Chris, no, I understand what you're saying. What I'm saying is that doesn't affect the player that's out. The player that's out, that's a whole different form of collusion. The betting the nuts doesn't matter at that point. The infraction is why did you raise to get this player out and then not continue the action?
Right, but if he doesn't bet the nuts, you can see why he didn't bet the nuts now, because he's friends with
the guy. Yeah, but it's two different things, though. Well, let's not get off track on that.
I'm not
going to be able to convince you you're wrong.
Well, that's what he said, too. He said even in tournament play. So, obviously, it's in cash games. I mean, I would think that there's a rule for you have to bet the nuts in cash games. So, I don't think it's just a tournament thing.
All right. And then the last thing he does say, though, is, you know, what if several players have the nuts in the hand? My understanding from talking to the tournament, it's only when you're the only one that has the nuts. If it's the undisputable nuts.
Okay.
In other words, you have an ace-high flush. No one else can have an ace-high flush if you have the ace in your hand. It's not if you have the Broadway, and four other people could have Broadway.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, didn't we have this a little while ago? Didn't we have this talk? Was it Was it during the horse tournament when you were?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was Omaha?
Came up. Yeah.
Yeah, Omaha.
Well, it wasn't Omaha. It was No Limited at that point.
Oh, okay. I thought it was something about the Ace Deuce or something in the Omaha round, or maybe I'm misremembering that. But I remember.
Definitely, people said the Indisputable Nuts.
Yeah,
so,
Indisputable Nuts.
Yeah. And not the nuts in the hand, too. I guess that's the other question, too. I mean, if, just be sure people understand, if there's three hearts on the board and you've got the Broadway, I mean, you're not compelled to bet that because you don't know you have the nuts.
Right.
Obviously, you don't. But obviously, Frank didn't mention that. But
I know what he's saying.
Situation.
Yeah, I mean, I get what he's saying. There are a lot of reasons to not want to bet the nuts, or there are at least a few, but it protects a lot more people by making you bet the nuts than not doing it. So
yep.
We have to have it. All right, housekeeping. You know, we're still looking for some ambassadors.
We are. Yeah. I hope. Well, maybe we've filled them.
Yeah, I don't know. I know it's a week later, but I'm fairly certain that from 2 weeks from now, we're still not from when we're doing this. We have nobody in the Pacific Northwest. If they want to, Seattle area or whatever, want to come on board and be the voice of your poker scene, let us know. Ohio is coming up quick. They're going to be opening their rooms pretty soon. And we still don't have anybody in Arizona either. We got someone who was interested, but we haven't heard back. So, hey, if you're in Arizona or you know somebody in Arizona who wants to do it near the Phoenix area and wants to be one of our ambassadors, let us know. You can apply at anyupmagazine.com/ambassadors.
And don't forget, you can miss out. You're missing out on all the great fun I'm having right now in the Antioch Poker Cruise because you're not here. Though other podcast listeners are. We're having a ball.
Yeah.
Might even be buying them drinks.
I think you bought them dinner, too, didn't you? You bought them all.
Yeah,
dinner.
Yeah. I'm buying them dinner every night. but check out our 2012 Poker Cruise schedule at AntiUpMagazine.com/cruise, and you can sail with us March 17th out of Tampa, August 27th out of Port Canaveral, and November 10th out of Baltimore.
All right. The much-anticipated, futuristic AntiUp News Desk.
Yeah, I feel like I have so much power here because I know what's going to happen. So I can pick and choose what I want to tell you guys. The future is really awesome, by the way, I should
say. Okay.
I look wonderful.
Oh, some, man.
Some advancements in plastic surgery. All right, here's what happens in the future that I know of. On April 15th, 2021, the 10th anniversary of Black Friday, players who had money on Full Tilt will receive 1/100th of their money they're owed and a membership in the Jelly of the Month Club. After the Department of Justice and the online site's new owners finally complete a deal.
So I just have to sit here and let you read them all, right? I don't
just put it on the calendar. You're going to get your money a little less than 10 years from now. Enjoy it. All right. Also, on June 5th, 2050, Annie Up, the longest-running poker cast on the planet, ends its weekly streak of producing shows at 39 years. It was a good run, buddy. After Chris ends our friendship, after I call Limit Omaha 8 for 3 straight rotations in the weekly home game at Green Grove Nursing Home. It's a retirement community.
Oh, my God.
And finally, the winner of the 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, and 2018 World Series of Poker Main Events are all 22 years old.
Oh, man. Nice job, buddy.
Hey, well, you know, it's tough. You know, you have to speed around in the future a little bit. You know, transportation is a little quicker. But
what's really sad is our poker cruise took 39 years for you to know about all these things and have to report back to us on them. That's sad.
We stopped at Gilligan's Island.
And it was still just $600 to cruise. Okay, we got a fresh new O'Malley's move.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're playing $2, $4, No Limit, Texas Hold'em. We're at a full ring game with around $400. Up a little bit, but not much to brag about. The table has been a mixture of players, from loose passive to loose aggressive, from tight passive to tight aggressive. We're in the under-the-gun position, and we look down at two black aces. Yep, probably one of the hardest hands to play. Ace-ace, under the gun, in a full ring game. But the standard raise at this table is 4x big blind, and we're not going to deviate from that. We make it $16 to go, and the under the gun plus one player, a loose aggressive, makes it $32, with roughly $225 behind. Oh great, here goes another raise with aces scenario, where everyone calls, and we end up folding on a coordinated flop. But to our surprise, it gets folded back around to us. We could put in a raise here, but we don't. Before I get crucified for this, let me explain. We've already achieved what we wanted. Heads up with a loose aggressive player who can't felt us. Plus, his raise from right behind us could mean anything, and we don't want to just get it all in pre-flop and leave it to chance. Not even with aces. We're going to see this flop, trust our reading capabilities, and try to outplay a much inferior opponent, as we've deduced from sitting next to him for the last hour. Additionally, if we just call here, our strength is disguised quite well. So we make the call, and the flop comes down a very friendly 8 of diamonds, tray of diamonds, deuce of clubs. With the pot at $70, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And another diamond coming on the turn. I think a check is in order here, and that's what we do. Our opponent immediately puts $70 into the pot, leaving him about $150 behind. Huh? Why the large bet? If he'd hit a set, he almost certainly would have slow played it. And if he was drawing, he would have checked right behind to see the turn for free, right? He's not tricky enough to play a set or a draw this way, so it's either an overpair or two big cards. We settle on two overcards because there's no way he's got us on two aces, so an overpair would most likely put in a smaller bet here, perhaps to see if we hit a set and are planning a check raise. A call from us is in order here, and we make it after thinking for a minute or two. We now are down to 300, but we're feeling fairly comfortable. The pot is 210, and the turn is the 7 of spades. Our opponent shoves his stack in out of turn before the dealer can do anything about it. He lets the player know the action's on us, and the bet is invalid. An interesting turn of events. Since we know his move already, we check again, and then he puts the rest of his chips in, for a total of 148. So it's 148 to win 358. We'd only be left with 150 behind. Are we calling?
Today's guest is one of the leading authorities on gambling and the founder of Cardoza Publishing, the largest gaming publisher in the world. He's recently published his first work of fiction, Lost in Las Vegas, and Avery Cardoza joins us today to tell us about it. Thanks for joining us, Avery.
Pleasure, Scott and Chris. I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. Well, you know, you have such a rich history, and we definitely want to talk about that later in the show, but let's get right into it and talk about Lost in Las Vegas. What prompted you to turn to fiction after all these years?
Well, I didn't plan this book. This book just sort of happened. I sort of came out of a dark period of my life when a lot of things went wrong, and one day I started writing, and the book started forming, and I had no plans to write a book. It just happened.
Now, you and I talked a little before the show about how I just finished reading it last night, and I have to tell you, I loved the theme of 13 throughout the book. I mean, it felt almost like I was reading a spinoff from the TV series Lost. I started looking for references to 13 throughout the book, you know, even if Ludo didn't point it out to me. And, you know, you said it took you 10 years about or so to write it, and of course 13 drafts. How come it took so long? Was it just you were waiting for experiences to happen or the time thing, or what happened there?
Writing fiction is a very difficult thing to do. And this book, for some reason, it was the most miserable experience of my life, writing this book. I worked very hard on it.
Wow.
I'd work 40-hour stretches. I'd work every day. It was just a terrible experience. So I can't tell you why it was so difficult. It just sort of, it's not something I planned on doing. It just sort of came out of me, this book.
Wow.
In a funny way.
All right, well, the book follows the exploits of John and Ludo, two friends who remain optimistic about their trip to Vegas even as it starts less than ideal. 24 hours later, their luck hasn't changed much at all, it doesn't sound like. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, basically, these two guys come to Las Vegas just to have a nice little trip. They're not real big partiers or drug dealers or anything, and just everything goes wrong. They meet a woman who one of them falls head over heels of instantly, and somehow she drags them through a whole nother world, and I'm sure that's not happened to anyone, meeting some woman going crazy afterwards. And these guys are soon out of their element. They end up in a poker game. One of them ends up in a poker game, John, and they're playing for a big dollar, and John thinks it's a dollar. But the truth finds out it's a big dollar. and he ended up losing all the money, and they happen to be playing with a bunch of killers who are just using it to blow off steam. So these guys take all their money, their ID, their credit cards, everything. So these guys walk out of that poker game owing a bunch of killers some thousands of dollars. Oh, they got no ID. They're afraid to go back to their hotel now because they got a problem with another set of people that John got in trouble with. And these are just things that could almost happen to anybody, except these guys are geniuses at it.
Oh, yeah.
And it goes downhill from there. These guys just end up with no money, no place to go. They can't go anywhere. They can't get money in because sort of a bunch of losers, a bunch of knuckleheads, these guys. And they end up washing dishes, and all they want to do is get the hell out of Vegas. But it's not so easy. Everything goes wrong.
Yeah, you know, you brought up the woman, the female character, and, you know, she comes into the book fairly quickly, and like you said, they pretty much fall for each other so quickly. And I know if my wife reads this book, she'll never let me go to Vegas again. but I was wondering if, you know, the character's name is ZZ. I wondered, was she based on anybody you knew, or was this sort of an amalgamation of characters?
Well, in general, with the characters, there's certain things that were inspired by people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I might have met a crazy woman in my day. I'll leave it at that. But most of the characters in the book, they're just pure figments of my imagination. It just came. The funny thing about this book is I was 150 pages into writing it. And I originally started writing it as a movie.
Oh, really?
And going back, I originally didn't even plan on writing it. I was just scribbling scenes and scenes and scenes. It turned into a project. I said, all right, I'll write a movie. So I kept my style kind of terse. And I wrote, after 150 pages, I realized this is way past what a movie should be.
Yeah.
And I really didn't want to write a movie. I wanted to write a book.
Right.
And, still at that point, I had no story. None at all. I mean, I just had a bunch of random scenes, you know, which is movies. Movies have random scenes, and they tie together.
Yeah.
And then one day, it occurred to me, something that happened to me in New Zealand. I used to travel around the world. I met a couple of people. I said, let's go to lunch. We had lunch. At the end of the meal, they said, come on, let's go. They wanted to skip out on the deal. I said, I'm not doing this. You know, I'm not just some foreign country. I don't want to stiff somebody. So these three took off, two guys and a girl, and I'm left there with a bill. I said to the manager, you know, I'm not paying it. I thought I didn't know these people. I'll pay my bill. He wasn't happy about it. But, you know, if I paid mine, I got out of there. And that occurred to me, and I corrupted that whole scene, and that sort of creates the scene where the trouble begins.
Man. I have to admit, when I was reading it, I thought she was a hooker when it first started. I thought this woman was just like a gold digging hooker or something, but it turns into a lot more than that. I don't want to spoil it for anybody. I want them to read it. It really was pretty insane.
Complicated person. There's a few complicated people that you never quite understand who they are.
Yeah,
that's how it is in life sometimes. You know, people get into situations with lovers and love interests, and sometimes things get tricky and they never quite know what's going on. And then the story sort of has. That's the situation that goes around these people.
It was awesome.
All right, the book has been described as, quote, Vegas as if presented by the Coen brothers, and, quote, Pulp Fiction meets Pulp Vegas. I know the dialogue between John and Ludo had me thinking of John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson. Was this the style of the book you were looking for once you decided that it became a book?
You know, I wasn't really influenced by any other book or movie. I used to be a big reader. And at the time I was writing this book, 10 years, I didn't read a book. I did not want to be influenced by anybody. I barely saw a movie. I don't want to have any influences at all. It's just the way it just came out of me in this way. And I sort of liken it somewhat to Pulp Fiction, that characters come back. There's a lot of craziness around this whole scene. And Coen Brothers' Kevin Pollak sort of compared it to that style. This is just what came out of me. I wasn't trying to do anything. And the funny thing is, you know, if I describe this book and the horrible experience I was writing it, something I said to myself every day, I don't want to ever have to go through this again. You know, 10 years of this.
Yeah,
you know, it's not easy writing fiction, and for something this was hard. And the one thing I didn't want to write, I've always wanted to write a novel, but I didn't want to write a comedy. And the irony is, this thing is, you know, people calling it the funniest book they've ever read. It's not something I've planned on writing, and I'm describing a terrible experience. How did a comedy come out of it? I don't know. And why did I write this book? You know, why would you do something you hate for 10 years and struggle every day hating it? Why would you do that? That I don't have an answer for.
Well, some of the funniest things in the book to me were when Mike Tyson was involved. And I have to ask you, it seems like all of a sudden he's everywhere with these buddies' Vegas trips gone awry. Did you think about that when, you know, you must have heard that he was in this Hangover movie? Did you think about changing that? And I also love that you sort of put yourself in the book, too. That was pretty cool.
Right. Yeah, well, the Tyson thing, it was, I saw the Hangover. I thought they did a great job. It was very funny.
Yeah.
It's just pure comedy. I wrote that scene, 8 years before they ever thought of the Hangover. That was probably in the first 6 months that scene was written in there. It's just coincidence. Mike Tyson is a Vegas figure, and I used to live down the street from him, actually.
Oh, okay.
I don't know him.
Right.
And it just seemed like a good, it just seemed to come into a scene. It's part of Vegas, and I thought that would be kind of fun. And that's how he came about, but no, it wasn't. It just be a Hangover. Also saw a good Vegas character in Mike Tyson.
Yeah.
All right. There's only so many,
You wrote your first book, Winning Casino Blackjack for the Non-Counter, in 1981 when you were 24 and had been banned from every casino in Las Vegas. I wonder now, can blackjack still be beaten these days with the six-deck shoes and 6-to-5 payouts on naturals?
Sure, you can still beat blackjack. There's several ways to beat blackjack. Card counting is at the heart of many of them. There's some very advanced and difficult techniques called shuffle tracking. There's a few other things that are maybe might be considered less than legal. But yes, the game can be beat, but it's difficult. It's always been difficult. It's a little more difficult now. Whether it's six decks or one deck doesn't make card counting that much more difficult, because all you're doing with card counting is keeping one number in your head. And that number is just telling you whether there's more tens or more smaller cards.
Right.
Or really high-value cards against small-value cards. And when there's more high-value cards in the deck, you have an advantage. When there's less than normal, the casino has an edge, and you adjust your betting accordingly. Now, the skill in blackjack, half the skill in blackjack is knowing how to win, and the other half is disguising that fact.
Now,
it's beatable, but it's difficult. And to beat any game that you have an advantage in, or even if you don't, it all comes down to money management. You need to manage your money intelligently. How many people have gone there and made a lot of money and then waited until it was all gone away instead of leaving when they were ahead? Or how many people have lost a bunch of money and said, please get me back to even, please. And somehow they get back to even. They go, one more bet, I just want to walk away with a victory. And all of a sudden it spirals out of control and they get the pants beat off them. And it comes down to, if you make smart money management decisions, you'll never, ever get hurt gambling at any game.
Well, I was glad to see that you had blackjack and poker figure importantly in your book that we just talked about. And I know that Cardoza Publishing's roster of poker authors is beyond compare. Brunson and Negreanu and Caro, of course, pretty much we've all read them all. But with so many poker books on the shelves these days, are there still poker titles that haven't been written? And if so, what do you think they are?
Poker's a deep game, and there's a lot of good stuff coming out still. But I think there's a good poker book that could be written basically on the proper play. You can look at it either from a psychological perspective or a mathematical perspective. But ultimately, the game comes down to math. If you make a bet, let's talk about No Limit Hold'em, so you could apply this to other games. You make a bet, you want either your opponent to call you because you want more money in the pot, or you want to get rid of them. And when you're making these bets, let's say you're trying to get rid of an opponent and take the pot for free, you make that bet, what's the chances that this guy is going to call you? Now, you sit there, you've played with him a little bit, you're trying to study him, you're really trying to read other people, and you're trying to block them from meeting you or give them signals where they misread you.
Right.
So if you could really boil down the math and say, all right, in this particular situation, against this type of player, I have a situation where my opponent's going to fold 7 out of 10 times. And now this is not exact science, because you never know. You're taking educated guesses, but you make enough educated guesses and studied enough, you can start developing a situation where your whole game is really about betting.
Right.
Not so much the cards. And when you play a good No Limit Hold'em poker player, and a good poker player, the cards are not the most important factor in a situation.
Yeah.
It's the dynamics, revolving around, is he going to call me or is he not going to call me?
Well, I want your opinion. This could be like the good idea that I just give away to somebody. But I've always talked about this on our show, and then even maybe to a lesser extent in our magazine, but I always felt like a shorthanded poker book would really do well. There's a lot of books out there that talk about shorthanded as chapters in their books, yeah. But nothing specifically dedicated to, you know, how do you play stud eight heads up, or how do you play, you know, Omaha three-handed or something. So I always thought a shorthanded book would do well. Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, definitely. So I don't want to write it.
Right.
I try not to write more of these books. I've written too many already. I agree with you. That's definitely needed. You know, there's a, you know, shorthand is a very different style of play, and it's I've done very well in the World Series in shorthanded tournaments.
Right.
And I play very differently than I do in a full-handed table, and I probably shouldn't play as differently as I do. But I just seem to do very well in these shorthanded tournaments.
I think you found another book to write.
I haven't gotten final table, but a couple of years ago on the three tournaments, on all three tournaments, I was a chip leader at one point or another.
Man.
Wow.
But I didn't get there. So.
Well, hey, I've never been a chip leader in a tournament like that, so you're still ahead of me, sir. all right, well, you own the Gambler's Book Club, truly a mecca of gambling books in Las Vegas. How often do you see customers that are more excited to be browsing your shelves than they are to be in Vegas itself?
It's a hard comparison. People come to Vegas, they let it all hang out. And my book, Lost in Las Vegas, sort of brings out the spirit of that, and, you know, as these two guys traipse through the place. But in the Gambler's Book Club, this is a place that's been around since 1964, originally started by John and Edward Luckman. And it's an institution where every famous mobster and gambler and casino owner has walked through the doors of this bookstore.
Man.
We have 3,000 titles on games, gambling, mafia, Vegas-type stuff, and it's 100 times what the largest bookstore in the world will have, like Barnes & Noble, New York, 5 floors, on Union Square. You go check out their selection of craps books, let's say, we'll have 100 what they have, a blackjack, a poker.
Yeah.
You know, we have probably 1,000 poker books in there. I don't know how many we have.
God.
And it's just an exciting, people come in, it's so exciting to see all this material just on gambling. It's the only store of its type in the world. And I bought it about a year and a half ago. It was about to go out of business, and I've been a customer there for a long time. I knew the Luckmans, and then it passed on to Howard Schwartz, who's been running it for maybe 30 years, and Howard's a real institution in himself and a legend, and just I couldn't let it go away. I had to save it, and it was almost an obligation that I had with my position in the gambling community, my knowledge of the book business, and my friendship with the store, that I felt it was an obligation to save the store. And so I saved it and still going. People are very excited.
I was really glad you did.
Yeah.
Well, you founded the lifestyle magazine Avery Cardoza's Player, which featured unique photos and interviews with dozens of celebrities over its five-year life. We have to ask you a little advice here. We're a couple of poker magazine publishers, and we're bucking the odds right now as we close in on our fifth year of publishing. You got any words of wisdom for us?
Whoa. It's tough. It's very tough. I mean, first of all, you need to stick with the niche you're in. You can't expand it too much. I mean, you could if you wanted to go into gambling in general, but you can't go far away from it, because your best chance in this very difficult environment where you're competing against other bigger magazines, you're competing against the internet and so many different things, and the advertising money is so tough to get, as you guys talk about every week, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
Basically, you've got to see. You have two challenges. One, the customer. What does your customer want to read? You know, and the one thing I find interesting is, in the magazine in general, is in addition to the hard-hitting poker stuff you're going to cover, lifestyle stuff is nice, easy reads, and kind of fun. And you can expand it a little bit sometimes. If you think it's appropriate, you might bring in something on cigars. You know, not saying it's correct for your audience. You can bring in, you know, maybe something about cars. If you know your audience is a bunch of guys in their 20s and 30s, to them.
Yeah.
So of course, never don't stray far from what this magazine is about. You know, it's about poker.
Right.
So that's the end. You know, just the tough battle is getting that advertising. As you know, it's a very difficult environment. It's getting more difficult. The print industry is going away, I think, whether it's magazines, newspapers, books. I think the whole thing is going to be a relic in some years.
Hopefully, yeah. We'll get out before then.
Your online presence is going to be where your business plan is going to have to lie.
That's we're working on it.
Print. Yeah.
Thanks, Avery.
All right, Avery. Hey, that's great advice. We love having you on the show. We don't want to keep you too long out there, but best wishes on the sale of the book, and please let our listeners know where they can get a copy of it and all your other books.
You can buy Lost in Las Vegas. You can buy it from CardozaBooks.com, our website, or there's a website, LostInLasVegas.com. where we have excerpts of the book and links and different stories that people have posted, or go through Amazon or Barnes & Noble, various places. But I guarantee you'll like it. Money back guarantee.
Wow.
There you go.
Thanks, man. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
This is Noah Brunson, and you're listening to Annie Up.
All right, back again with another situation.
Excellent.
Although I spelled it situation on the notes, I noticed. So I think that's French for something.
For situation.
Maybe. That'd be too easy.
For occurrence. It's French for occurrence.
All right, here's our situation for the week. It comes from our good buddy, Jerem. He always sends us good stuff. And this time, Chris, he's in a charity tournament. $100 buy-in, $60 goes to the prize pool.
Okay.
And he said he was definitely sticking to ABC poker, except that he was willing to speculate because there were a lot of limping going on. He started with 3,500 in chips, and he was up to 5,700 in the fourth level. Pause for Chris's.
That's pretty good. You know, I expect tournaments to build your stacks up. It's always the cash games that annoy me.
It's cash games, yeah, bro. Yeah. All right. Cool.
No one ever goes broke in cash games on our home, our hands to
week. That's true. That's true. Up to 5,700 in the fourth level, where blinds are at 150-300. He says he was in middle position with ace of clubs, queen of clubs, and he raises it to 900.
All right.
One of the better players who has been really active with a yo-yo stack that sits about 5,900. Wouldn't it be great if your stack was like on a string? Instead of chip shuffling, you're just like, you know, walking the dog.
Walking the dog around the world.
All right, so this active player has 5,900 in his stack, and he calls from the big blind. All the other players are full. So we're heads up. All
heads
right. up. Pot's 2,250. The flop comes king of diamonds, nine of clubs, tray of diamonds. Big blind checks, and our hero c-bets 1,600, leaving him 3,200 behind. Big blind calls, leaving him with 3,400 behind. The turn is the eight of hearts, so our board now is king of diamonds, nine of clubs, tray of diamonds, eight of hearts. And our hero is feeling done with his hand at worst and ready to check and get lucky on the river at best. The big blind checks, and he checks behind. So now he's firmly putting him on a draw, maybe jack 10 or a diamond draw. I know some like to bet the draw, but he's getting short, so maybe that's why he hesitated. I just don't want to risk the check raise, so that's why I checked. I'm happy to keep the pot from floating too much. And he's asking us in the middle of the situation whether that's a mistake.
I don't think so. You know, we took our stab. He could be solo playing. It's a coordinated board. It's not a incredibly coordinated because Jack 10 or whatever is a gut shot draw. So, I don't know. I don't dislike the check behind at all. We have nothing. We could be being trapped. We didn't pick up a draw on the turn, so we still have nothing but ace high, and we're controlling the size of this pot. I don't dislike the check at all. I'm not one for firing again unless I know the guy will fold. And if he's trapping, maybe that's why he only called, because he could be trapping.
Yeah.
You know, with such a short stack. I don't like the bet again there.
We're just too short here, I think, to make a bet when we have this king on the board and we have ace queen and really no hope of improving too much.
Yeah.
All right. So the pot is still 2,250. The river is the king of clubs. So our final board is king of diamonds, nine of clubs. Tray of diamonds, eight of hearts, king of hearts.
King of clubs.
King of clubs. Yeah. Ooh, nice little update there for me.
I tried to fix it for you, but in time.
I was too quick. All right, so one more time. Final boards, king of diamonds, nine of clubs, tray of diamonds, eight of hearts, king of clubs. Big blind studies the board and puts in 1,700. To our hero, that's a curious bet. He checked the flop and turn. Could he really have a king in his hand? Relative to the pot, this is not an unusual bet size, but with only 1,700, just over five big blinds behind, I don't think it makes sense. Just seems weak, like he's unwilling to pull the trigger and just put it all in there. Maybe it's just a vibe I got when he bet. I had nothing but ace high here and decide he's bluffing. The question is, how can I win this pot? Even if he's taking a shot with a hand like nine of diamonds, ten of diamonds, or ace of diamonds, tray of diamonds, which might have played it like this, I can't beat him. But I still can't get over the fact that he didn't just push all his chips.
I know I don't have much fold equity either. $400, and I am all in, and he'll be nearly all in if he calls. After a couple of moments, he folds and grumbles, quote, I wanted you to think I had the king. Did you have it? I answered a question of my own, busted flush draw? He answered yes, and I said, yeah, I had the king, just hoping to keep the image up that I was on heater, not making a play. So I think I made a good read here, but I'm wondering if I just got lucky. Obviously, I had a little fold equity here, so my only chance to win is if he has nothing at all, and I was right about that. But upon further review, was this too risky? We'll pause here before he continues to talk.
Okay, so he went all in for his final $3,400. I feel like it's a bad play. I mean, that's got to be a rock-solid, unbelievable read on this guy to not know that he has ace-nine and that he was betting his hand for value thinking you don't have a king.
Yep.
And was cautious on the flop. And then when the king came on the turn, he hit the eight. So I can see him checking it. Maybe if he has a nine, maybe he does bet the turn when you check to him. Or no, he checks first. So maybe, you check to him, right? Or he checked to you. Where'd it go?
He's a big blind.
Okay, so yeah. So I just feel like that's really risky. This guy easily could play this hand with ace-nine or 9-10 and a value bet on the end. I just don't think that if he does have that nine and you made that move that he can fold for that what's left in the pot. I feel like that's not enough for him to just fold now. If he's betting, it's tough for me to see him folding even though he did fold in his hand. That king could even be... He does have a king, and he solo played it. Yeah, I think he's right that it's weird that if he had the king, he wouldn't have bet the turn.
Yeah.
But even so, I think that a nine might call you there and can't fold for the amount that he put in on the river and then has to call on the end. So I just feel like that is a really risky play that only gets called by a hand that's made and only folds if he has absolutely nothing. So to shove with that minimum amount when somebody's bluffing hoping somebody's bluffing is a tough, tough move, I think. That's a tough move to make. You got to be spot on. And to know your player that he's not just folding, you know, I mean, that he will fold with nominal holding. That's a real risky play.
Well, I think it's... I think there's a little interesting stuff going on both hands, and Jerem continues his letter to say that he thinks it's just interesting to consider how the big blind played it, so I'm going to read his comments there, and then we can talk more. He says, one thought I had was his comment showed me that even though at the time I was thinking primarily the second level here, it was third level thinking. What does he think I have that might have led me to the same decision? But why does he think I'm checking behind the turn if I have a king in my hand and another drawing card just hit? Wouldn't I be betting it again to discourage the draw? He basically said that he would have folded even if he had a decent hand there. Now, does he really fold if he has a nine in his hand, two pair? I don't know. Should he? Finally, if he does show a king in the end, could you argue that his river bet was a value bet and that's why he didn't shove? My buddy told me it was fishy and that he would have folded there, and he would have called a shove thinking it was just to scare me. What's funny is that I think that even if he shoved, I do fold there, even if I don't believe him, because I still have 12 big blinds or so left, and it looks like maybe he was just trapping with his two checks and a king in his hand. So we both looked at the scenario differently, but it gave me food for thought. You?
I mean, I as the opponent, I don't like the bet on the end because it doesn't make sense. You know, if you have a nine, you're happy to show it down. If you have the king, you would have bet the turn. I don't believe his. I mean, if he bet 1700, I don't know if I can call that. Because I think he could have a nine. He's betting it for value, but he might just show it down. I don't know. That's an interesting bet that guy made.
Yeah.
I don't think I could call 1700 with ace high either. And the shove to me was just only min raising. I don't know. That's a real interesting bluff that we made with ace high, and even more interesting bet that the guy made for 1700 with a busted flush draw.
Well, I think it's important to remember that we're both short stack going into this hand, and I think that that affects our play a little bit. So, you know, if we have deeper stacks, then I think the big blind's play is a little fishier. But I might argue a little bit that he might have played this way with a king, like a weak king. I'm trying to remember. We raised what? We raised preflop, so maybe not a weak king. I might take that out of the equation. But if for some reason he has a weak king, I mean... I'm really not worried about draws anywhere through this hand, right?
Well, wait a minute. If you're taking weak king out, what king is this guy playing for raising? King Jack?
That's what I'm saying. I think that kills my devil's advocate here because I don't think you're gonna be playing anything.
Yeah.
You're right. Maybe King Jack. Maybe.
And I'm completely worried about draws because there's diamonds on board and now a straight draw on the turn.
But we're playing heads up too. Yeah, you're right. But if we check and they check and then we check on the turn and we check again.
I can't check the turn with any king in my hand. I would raise with Jack 10 in the blinds. So Jack 10 now is a drawing hand at the turn. And it's just too many hands are getting there now. If I have a king, I got to at least bet the turn, not give him a free look at the river, and I don't. So I can't believe that he has three kings.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. See, you convinced me.
Okay, good.
It's almost impossible to think that he has a king there.
Yeah.
But you're right. So then the question becomes, you know, if he doesn't have a king, does he have a 9, a 3, or an 8, and which has his beat?
Yeah. But would he be able to call another 1,700? It does feel like it's such a value bet on the end. He's so short, why would he bet the king unless he had reason to believe that he had the best hand? So it's a nice attempt, but it's an attempt that when he says, I tried to make you think I had the king, no one's going to believe that. They might believe you have ace-nine, you're value betting ace-nine, but again, I would rather just show down ace-nine, and because we bet our king pretty strong. But then again,
so let me ask you, if the big blind would have shoved on the river, I mean, obviously, knowing that he thinks that we know that he doesn't have a king, but he puts us to a test for whatever we have.
Yeah, I can't call. I would rather have fold and have my big blinds have a chance than to be
wrong.
That's
what I'm saying. So, I mean, was the big blinds a better play to shove on the river?
I think a better play is to shove. I mean, again, that value bet is interesting. It makes me think, holy shit, he can't afford to lose that money, you know? And I'm not going to beep that word out either. I like saying it. So, it's kind of a conundrum there. I feel like it's a nice attempt by him to bet pretty much half his stack or a little less than half his stack on the end to make it look like it's a value bet, because if he had anything, he normally would shove in that situation. When he didn't shove, he's trying to tell you, I have something I want to get paid off with. So it's some thinking involved with that bet, but I don't think the king is the betting line that I would believe. I would think it's like ace nine or whatever, or even pocket sevens or something that, you know, I don't know, some other hand that you wouldn't re-raise with, but you'd call a raise with pre-flop. And
Well, it's the ultimate game of chicken, I think, because we're both, if either one of us makes a mistake here, we're out of this tournament. Yeah. We're all on, you know, and so I think the fact, now again, I worry about that more than I think most players do, because I'm a firm believer that once my chips are gone, I can't do anything, so I'm going to protect them a little bit more, where I think other people use them as a bully, and don't worry about it. But to me, if I'm playing somebody like me, it's tough here, because it's tough to make the move either way, because if you're wrong, you're out. And if you do make the move, then you're putting the other player to a test on the same thing.
Yeah.
If he's the type that doesn't really care, then that's a bad move to make. But if he's the type that is concerned about going out, then, you know, that shove, you know, it's almost like, you know, saying, hey, you know, I don't have it, but my nothing's better than your nothing. And do you want to really put your tournament at risk to find out whether your ace high is good or your...
Yeah. Most of the time, though, my nothing is better than your nothing comes when we're both big stacked and you're just trying to get somebody off a hand or still poker to be played. This was, hey, you know what, I have to be 100% right here and with my tournament life on top of it, and that's just tough to do. But, you know, the good news is it's charity, so.
Yeah, and the happy ending, he says, is that he won the tournament won about $1,000.
Wow. Man.
And not only did he brutalize this guy with his shove on the end, he made some nice cheddar. So.
Yeah, he showed that he wasn't just a one-trick pony, that he can make more than just one good move. He can take it down, too. So, nice job, man.
All right, Jerem, we always appreciate when you send in stuff for us to talk about. And a reminder to everyone else, email your hands of the week to podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and we'll be happy to send you something great, like an uncut sheet of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Antiup. You can only win the uncut sheets, but you can buy the cards in the Antiup store at antiupstore.com.
And time's running out for those too, right?
Yeah, it's only through the end of the year, so a couple more shows to get your uncut sheets, so do it now.
All right, I want to thank Avery Cardoza for coming on the show and being a good sport, and enjoyed his book, Lost in Las Vegas. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.
I'm okay. I'm hiding from my twin boys. If they see me, I can't talk. So I'm in a garage right now.
Oh, excellent. All right. Well, we won't keep you long unless you want us to keep you really long if you're trying to hide from
Oh, no, I'm fine. I'm fine as long as they don't see me. I'm